Thank you, brother. That was excellent and very interesting. I was wondering, you had mentioned that there are some of those brethren who are rather aggressive and kind of attack and try to insult your intelligence, and they fired kind of shotgun questions at you, like, what about the Jerusalem church? How would they deal with it? I was wondering if you could help maybe address arguments like that, or if you would even consider it a good idea to address arguments like that.
Yes, I can tell you how I address those arguments. I say, have you read my book? And until they do, I won't talk to them any further. That is, you know, I guess we don't all have to write a book to avoid the argument, but I did. I put this together in part so that I could say to people, when they take that approach and pepper me with questions that will lead to, you know, what some people call lily padding, jumping from one issue to the next, you can never adequately answer one. They'll never acknowledge that you have given an answer. They'll just go to another question. I would say this book may not be it, but if you can find a resource that you believe is an adequate, thorough address of the material, give that to them and say, if you'll read this, then I'll talk to you. Because those arguments have been answered over and over and over again. Now, there is probably more material to be found. Just recently, Everett Ferguson, who is a professor at Abilene Christian University, published a book in which he had a chapter on the laws in ancient Rome dealing with assemblies, public assemblies. And in that chapter, he essentially makes the case that it would have been impossible, legally, for the Jerusalem church to gather every Sunday in crowds of 10 to 15 to 20,000 and participate in Christian worship in the public eye. And I've been using that resource and trying to hunt down some similar material to collect it for maybe another book. There are some difficult questions about the Jerusalem church. If there was only one congregation in Jerusalem, that's the argument that they make. Most of us would probably say there were more congregations in Jerusalem that met in brethren's homes. That's certainly the position that I do take. But the challenge would then be in Acts 6, the selection of the deacons. Were these deacons who were super congregational, who served in multiple churches at the same time? I think probably the better answer to that is that the book of Acts gives us snapshots into the disciples' lives and leaves a lot of information out, just like the book of Genesis does in its early chapters when it talks about the condition of early man. There are questions we might ask that are simply not answered, but we use the material that we do have to draw necessary conclusions. And I think that if we do that, the necessary conclusion will be that the best reconstruction of the situation in Jerusalem was that the many thousands of Christians who were there before the persecution drove them away would have met in the homes of believers in pretty private and intimate settings. I think that we can make an argument for that, but I think that there's probably a lot more evidence supportive of that than we realize. And it would be good for someone, somebody, to take up the task of doing that research and publishing that in more detail.
Austin Matt.
Very much appreciated your comments. As you know, that's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. You know, particularly, you mentioned about the fact that, sadly, and it's very troublesome and gruesome, we want to think that it's only a couple of issues that separate us from them. And sadly, that's not the case, as much optimism as we would like to exert towards that that thing. So I actually have two questions. The first is, as far as labeling, what we oftentimes call that brotherhood or various. You mentioned that sometimes using those terms can be very difficult because They're not exactly exclusive one to another, perhaps. There are some that say that they aren't brethren at all, that they are rather a denomination, which in virtually everything except for the name and perhaps baptism, we can see that that argument play out. So my question is there an appropriate name that we should be using in reference to these, or is that an impediment for us? Is that a problem for us to be labeling? My second question is, you may have touched on this, but when it comes to the bread and breaking the bread into more than one piece, historically, when was the first occasion that's documented on that, whether that be the practice of intinction or what that might be?
On the first question, I don't like people labeling me, and I don't want to do something to someone else that I don't want them to do to me. That being said, I probably did it in my presentation, inadvertently. I've tried to use terminology more like this. I've tried to say the brethren who use multiple loaves and multiple cups or something like that. I've tried to say that instead of calling them digressives or liberals or something along that line that might inflame relations between us and keep them from taking me seriously. And certainly I make that a concerted effort whenever I speak to people. And but when you get used to talking another way, sometimes old expressions creep into your conversation. That's true of all of us, I think. So I think, you know, if we believe that they're Christians, that they are our brothers and sisters in Christ, and I believe they are, unless I have reason on an individual basis to think otherwise. When I meet someone who's a member of the Church of Christ, I think that he is a Christian. And maybe he's doing things that are erroneous, things that could cost him his soul. But I'm going to treat him and speak to him as a brother instead of as someone who has never known Jesus and never submitted to him in any respect whatsoever. As far as the loaf issue, probably Justin Martyr's quote. I mean, I do think that you've got to take it somehow. They were carrying the emblems to the sick, and nobody seems to think that they just took loaf and cup from house to house, but they seem to have separated them somehow. Intinction is the oldest historical explanation of how they did it. And so they wouldn't have divided the loaf that way during the assembly, but at the end, they would break the loaf into as many pieces as were needed to serve the sick people they were going to visit. They would soak the loaf in the juice that was in the cup, and then they would take the soggy bread and administer it to those who were ailing, which I do believe is an unscriptural practice, and that would have been the earliest example of that.
Appreciate it. You mentioned in this last kind of area for future emphasis on the covenantal system and the sign of the covenant in regards to how the King James has hindered some in understanding the concept of the cup and the covenant. Can you explain that a little further? And my question is, does the cup represent the written covenant of the New Testament?
So we know that the words in most of our English versions, unless you use the Living Oracles or one of those translations that tried for absolute continuity of translation, most of our English versions will render the same phrase, is it diatheke, both covenant and testament, depending on its context. I think there is only one context where testament is the appropriate translation, and that's Hebrews 9, 16 and 17. When he talks about the testament requires the death of the testator. If you translate the word covenant there, then the statement of the Hebrew writer is wrong, because a covenant does not require the death of the mediator of the covenant in order for it to be in action. What he says is true of a testament, which is a later Greek concept. But most of the time when that word is used, it does not refer to a testament, a written declaration of one's will, but it refers to a covenant, which is a much more ancient concept, a contractual agreement between parties. And there is an elaborate system that was present among many ancient covenants. And we can see that system reflected in the Bible. We can see a continuity between descriptions of covenants in ancient Assyrian writings and the covenants we read about in the Bible, such as cutting the calf in two and passing between the pieces in Jeremiah chapter 34, in Genesis chapter 15. The killing of the animal was the ceremony that sealed or ratified or inaugurated or instituted the promise, which is basically what the covenant was, the commitment. The killing of the animal would seal that in blood. This is what Moses calls the blood of the covenant in the passage in Hebrews chapter 8 and 9. And then the covenant would be signified by some sort of a memorial or token. And this is common in the covenants of the Old Testament. I'm certainly not the first person to preach this. I've heard many preachers talk about this through the years, how the rainbow was the sign of God's covenant with Noah. Circumcision was the sign of God's covenant with Abraham. The Sabbath was the sign of God's covenant with Israel. What is the sign of God's covenant with the church? What is the sign of the new covenant? The symbol that doesn't symbolize a written document, but memorializes the agreement that God made between us and him through the blood of Jesus. And I believe Jesus identifies the shared cup in the Lord's Supper as the sign of the new covenant. And I think that there's a lot to be learned from that. There's more that can be said. I've got a whole chapter where I explore that in the book. There's more to be said about that than I have the knowledge to say. But I think that there's more study that needs to be done on that why. See, another aspect of that is the covenant meal. This is much more vague in the Bible. But we do see many times when a covenant was made, the covenanting parties would then eat together, a fellowship meal, to demonstrate the unity that they now had. The elders ate before the presence of God on Mount Sinai. Abraham ate with God in Genesis chapter 18. When Laban and Jacob make their covenant, they eat together right after the covenant has been sealed. And I think the Lord's Supper is a covenant meal in which we are celebrating our fellowship with God through the covenant of Jesus Christ. And I believe that the sign of the new covenant has been placed within the Lord's Supper, and that's the sharing of the cup. I think there's some deep theological meaning into that that we miss if we just say, okay, the cup is the New Testament. Well, that's 27 books of Christian scripture, and that's what it symbolizes. I think that's a very unfortunate misreading that comes from the King James Version, translating New Testament there when it really should be New Covenant. I hope that's an efficient summary, at least, of the issue.
Jacob Kelso.
Thank you for your thoughts, Brother Clint. I certainly enjoyed your lesson, and it was very informative on things that I had not known before. You were discussing the deacons of old would take the loaf dipped in grape juice to those that were unable to attend services. And that leads me to the question that I know others have on their mind as well. What is to be done with the loaf after the end of services? Some brethren will give it to the little kids. Others will perhaps not treat it with the proper respect that it has, because some brethren that I've talked to, and I am in agreement with, are of the opinion that you should treat it with respect. You wouldn't leave it floating in the church toilet for someone else to see.
Well, just saying. I'll tell you this. Now, I've been asked this question everywhere, and I think if I had written a book on that, I'd be sold out already, because it's been asked everywhere I go. It's an old question. My great-grandfather, mine and G.V.'s great-grandfather, who was the man that brought our family into the church, he would take the loaf and bury it in the backyard after the Lord's Supper and dump the grape juice in the hole with the loaf and bear it every Sunday. That's what he did. Wayne McCamey told me he was down in Mexico and a frantic sister urged a meeting with him. So he went to her home and she took him into a sort of an inner sanctum, a closet deep in the house, and showed him hundreds of jars of bread fragments and grape juice. She had collected all of the leftover remnants of the emblems for the last 30 years because she didn't know what to do with them. I'll tell you, the Bible does not tell us what to do with them. And so I would not condemn a person for how he handled, I mean, anyone who does something that is intentionally blasphemous or profane, obviously that's wrong. But a person who says, well, the Lord's Supper is over, and so we're going to throw away the bread and we're going to pour the grape juice in the sink and wash the cup out, I have no grounds on which to condemn that as irreverent behavior, because the Bible simply does not say what should be done with the leftover emblems. That's my thought on it, at least.
Okay, we don't have any more. What do we do now?
Hey, I thought it was a very, very good presentation. I am one of those people that in the past have talked about the 1890 date, so I appreciate you enlightening me of that. That's very good. Question I have is, you listed those three positions, the traditional, the moderate, the progressive. You didn't really focus on the moderate that I heard, and so I want to ask a question about that group. You lit the implication that that's the more reasonable group to talk to. What, in your talking with those brethren, have you found to be their primary point of argument? If they were going to use one argument, you know, what's their go-to?
Brother, this is what's so frustrating, and could, if I don't keep my composure, could push me over the limit, is that they have none. They're reasonable. They will listen to what we say. They'll say, that makes sense. I can see that. That is what the Bible teaches. But what keeps them where they are is their relationships. And I don't know what to do with that. I've had conversations with people who, and I mean, there are some of these men who could argue for one loaf and one cup as good or better than I can. One of them attended one of the presentations that I gave in Alabama, and he was arguing our side to his own brethren. And one of them said, sort of like the Pharisees, are you his disciple? Are you one cup now? And he said, well, no, but what he says makes sense. And what you're saying doesn't make any sense. And that's been months ago. And I don't see any movement on his part. You know, his dad's an elder. His father-in-law's an elder. He writes me and he says, well, my father-in-law's friends with some guy in Tennessee who's really against one-cup people, and he's been on the phone with him. And that's the thing. And I don't know what to say about that except to press him that he's going to have to give an account to God on what he knows the Bible teaches, but that there just seems to come a point when that's all you can do anymore with the moderate group.
Can I follow up to that real quick? I went to this institutional, non-institutional debate, or it was not a debate, a discussion in Henderson a couple months ago, and Kyle Pope was the non-institutional, and can't even remember the guy's name. He said, why don't you believe in one cup? So he had 2 minutes. His choice was Luke 22 and the dividing of the cup. So he believed in this big container in the from that small containers. It came to my mind whenever they used that argument. And this seems to be like, I don't know, Kyle's acted like he maybe is this moderate group, you know. I don't know. He says Luke 22 is his argument. It would seem that they would have to take the conclusion in the original supper they used individual cups, and they have to basically stick to that. Do you talk to a lot of brethren that actually, I guess, emphasize that factor, and Luke 22 is their argument?
Yes. In fact, I have four appendices in this book dealing with the Luke 22 issue. It is a pretty common argument. I would not characterize a man who makes that argument as a moderate. I think that that argument is an argument that is very easily disproven. And when a person is adamant on it and insistent on it, I think that that generally is a good identifier that this person is not going to be very reasonable. There are several things to take into consideration, and I won't eat up all of our time with that, but I'll just say I've got several appendices on it at the end of the book that explore all of the relevant data. Were there multiple Passover cups being used, or is there any way of reading Luke 22 that causes problems for the one loaf, one cup position that seems legitimate? And I conclude that there's not, that the text in Luke is very supportive to our position and teaches that Jesus commanded them to share the cup among themselves. When we talk about, I don't want to make a judgment on Brother Kyle Pope. I don't know him personally. He's written extensively against our brethren before that debate in his commentary on Matthew, quotes from Ronnie Wade quite a bit in that commentary. But I will say that sometimes you might find a man who seems moderate within that discussion, institutionalism versus non-institutionalism, but would not be moderate toward us. And I'll give the example. Brother Pope talked about the fact, well, it was Brother Burleson who he was debating or discussing, Doug Burleson. Doug Burleson said that he was discouraged from being a part of that discussion by older preachers. That older preachers said, Doug, we built these walls for a reason. You're tearing down walls that you don't know why they're there, and this is going to cause problems. And he said, but you know, we've got to tear down walls like this so we can have a conversation and have unity. Now, I happen to know that when the brethren in Birmingham suggested having me come down and speak on the Lord's Supper at the same study organized by the brother who organized that discussion in Tennessee, the brother who organized that discussion said, we're not going to talk about one cup. That issue has been settled for years and there's no point in bringing it up again. You see, the same attitude. So, sometimes I've just been preparing you that sometimes that's the case, so you won't be so disappointed when you see the inconsistency. But there are people, I think there's a large number among their brethren who are open-minded. And if you can find someone who is open-minded and who also has enough conviction to turn his life upside down for the sake of Jesus, you can make progress. So bountifully.
Five rice here. This will be our last question.
As you know, Clint, my family, most of them are of those that use individual cups and multiple loaves. Sometime back, about a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to study with the elders of one of the congregations where most of my family goes. It goes back to what you said a while ago about relationships. One of them was my cousin. Another one was a guy I grew up with, been knowing all my life. Up until the very last, the night before the study, everybody was all excited about it. He called me, told me, we talked about what time. Well, about 5 minutes later, he called me back and said his father said, who was there when individual cups was placed on the table, the only one left in that congregation, matter of fact, told him, no, we're not going to study, that I was going to cause division in the church. Well, I say this, we should always hope and continue to work because of relationships. One day they're going to end. It's sad to say, but one day he's going to be gone. I might have the opportunity to study with those two guys again. I look for that opportunity. And as evidenced by Owensboro, Kentucky, mm-hmm. where those men there heard it taught, they took a stand for the church. We learned something from them too, though. And Brett has mentioned being very careful and very, very leery to let the one man that's there that's very, very aggressive and wants to talk to the brethren, he left. But you have to be careful about that because he needs to be studied in what he's presenting and not cause harm, more than do good, and certainly we need to learn from that. But I think the point is, and another thing you talked about a while ago, there's a lot of churches. There's churches in our area, one in particular, don't even have Church of Christ on it anymore. But because of those going to instrumental music, having different services, contemporary and traditional and all this stuff, there are people just like flocking away from that church, going to other churches in the area. I think in the future, there's going to be great opportunities for us. We don't need to give up. And certainly we need to continue to work for that. And I appreciate your work and what you've done. That book's a great, great help. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I believe the same thing. If I'd given this presentation 8 months ago, it would have been a lot more naturally optimistic. But in the last 8 months, I've really struggled as I've seen my wheels spin with some people who I've come to really love. And so as I was writing this a few weeks ago, I thought, how in the world am I going to do this without getting up and just saying, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. I don't want to come across like that, because I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I've seen positive things. I don't know what I should be expecting. I don't know what any of us should be expecting as far as when and what and how. How quickly does it happen? And exactly what happens? What is success? Of course, if they would abandon their innovations and come take a stand with us next Sunday, that would be a wonderful success. But maybe there's smaller manifestations of success as well that are hard to notice in this moment, but will have a positive impact sometime down the road. Maybe so. So we just have to keep working. We know that this is the will of God.